Subscribe to The Spectator in September and get 3 months of website and app access absolutely free. Follow the Tory leadership campaign, Labour's inaugural budget, and the US elections with Britain's best informed journalists. And get your first 3 months free, only in September. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/sale24.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. This week, we ask whether the presidential race is now Kamala Harris's to lose. We meet the paedophile hunters going viral online, and we debate the moral minefield of the hotel breakfast buffet.
A lot of towns don't want to talk about it because they're so embarrassed by it. In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country, and it's a shame.
That was former President Donald Trump speaking during Tuesday's presidential debate with Kamala Harris. The consensus, even in Republican circles, seems to be that Harris came out on top. She managed to avoid sticky issues about her political past and goaded Trump into some rambling and, at times, somewhat outrageous remarks. So, was this debate a game changer in the race to be the next US president, in the same way that the Trump-Biden debate was? That's the question Freddie Gray asks in the magazine this week, and he writes our cover. The headline is Game On, Freddie Gray on America's Very Unpredictable Election. Amber is Washington editor at Spectator World, and we spoke to them the morning after the debate to talk about how the debate went. I started by asking Freddie whether he thought Kamala Harris came out on top, but only because Trump seemed so weak.
Yes, to a certain extent. I think she was slightly better than probably people expected, and Trump was slightly worse. And Trump has never actually been very good at one-on-one presidential debates, unless he's debating somebody who's senile. Harris is not senile, and she's definitely grown in confidence. She's the kind of word salads that she's been associated with as vice president seem to be less. And Trump does seem a little bit wrong-footed by her, simply because it's hard to grapple with somebody who is simultaneously trying to be a change candidate and a continuity candidate. At times, she is the person who's behind all the great things that Joe Biden has done. At other times, she says, I'm not Joe Biden. She is also says her values have remained constant, and yet she's distanced herself from a lot of positions that she's held in the past. So she's an extremely slippery character, and Trump seems ill-equipped because he's not a master of detail. He's not very good at sort of pinning people down intellectually or in a kind of big way. And he just doesn't seem able to grapple with her.
Amber, I would love to know your thoughts on the debate. You wrote for The Spectator's website that Americans were failed by the debate. Why do you say that?
I think on all three counts, between Trump, Kamala, and the moderators, there was no effort really to illuminate voters as to what these individuals would do when office, and no one was really prosecuting a case effectively against another. I mean, Trump had three obvious points that he could have made against Kamala Harris. One, of course, on the policy flip-flops, which he brought up several times, but never really cogently made the point that she actually believes the radical things that she did in 2019 and is just playing to the middle now because, as Bernie Sanders says, she needs to win an election. He did not really get into the idea that Kamala Harris has repeatedly claimed credit for the supposed successes of the unpopular Biden administration. And he allowed himself to get baited by her repeatedly, particularly on the point about crowd sizes. Now, Kamala Harris offered not much in the way of policy beyond platitudes. And most voters who were looking for something out of this debate were looking for Kamala Harris to actually tell them what she planned to do if she became president. I don't think anyone walked away from this debate any clearer on what exactly her platform is. And then on the moderator front, they were more interested in trying to live fact check Trump and make him look like the bad guy and the liar than they were in trying to run a well-organized debate that was actually eliciting information from both candidates. So from start to finish, I think a lot of people who tuned in just felt disappointed.
Freddie, could you talk a little bit about those key battleground states and whether you think this debate would have had much of an effect on voting intention?
Well, one kind of important point to consider is that early voting is beginning in earnest quite soon, if not now. Postal voting will start this month in several of those key battleground states. I think that the debate, because it's happened now, will therefore be fresh in voters' minds when they are casting those mail-in ballots. So that is a point in favour of Kamala Harris. However, the latest polling, this big New York Times Siena poll over the weekend, showed that Harris's momentum, such as it was, has slowed down. She is less likely than Trump to win the election, according to that poll. And Trump is considered by voters, and this is something Democrats find very hard to understand, but it's always been true. Trump is considered to be by voters to be far more moderate than Democrats want him to be. And indeed, voters consider Harris to be far too left-wing. They don't consider, by the same number, Trump to be far too right-wing.
Amber, the Harris campaign seems to be rather happy following the debate. They've even requested a second one before the election. Do you think that's realistic, or is that just not going to happen now?
It seems unlikely. It took quite a bit of back and forth for the candidates to even agree on the ABC debate, which in retrospect looks like Trump was right to be hesitant of sitting at ABC with these moderators. And I think it's unlikely that his team would agree to another liberal mainstream media outlet to host a debate. He has, of course, suggested he'd like to have it on Fox News, but during a Fox and Friends interview this morning, he said that he would not want Bret Baier and Martha McCallum, who are typically the debate head honchos, to be running it either. He would want one of the primetime opinion hosts like Jesse Waters or Sean Hannity, which is probably a no-go for Kamala Harris. So they'll have to decide on a venue, they'll have to decide on moderators, they'll have to decide on an outlet, and of course, they'll have to decide on rules. Last night, there was a lot of fighting over whether the microphone should be muted between candidates speaking or whether they should remain on. And during the sort of 11th hour, ABC decided to turn on the microphones if something newsworthy was said, which of course is a very subjective way of running a debate. There's just a lot that I think was not in Trump's favor last night based on the moderation and the rules that his team will be very eager to avoid the second time around. Now, that being said, I would caution the Kamala campaign. They might be having a little bit of a fatal conceit here because Trump historically always performs better in a second debate. I believe he was considered to have won the second debates against both Hillary and Joe Biden. So maybe they should just take this W and run with it and not look back.
Fred, you talk in your piece about the role that identity politics is playing in all of this. And last night we also saw Taylor Swift giving her endorsement and her Cats endorsement to Kamala Harris. Can you talk a bit about the role of that in this particular battle?
Taylor Swift is obviously the biggest celebrity in the world, and her endorsement will be seen to be very important. I'm not sure how important it will actually be. I read a very interesting article about Swifties for Trump last week, and these quite endearing women who say, I know she hates Donald Trump, I don't care. As for identity politics, I think Republicans underestimate it at their peril. Because, yes, most conservative people, most independent-minded people are fed up with the kind of hyper-woke values of the Democratic Party. But an enormous number of Americans have been through an education system that teaches them to view the world primarily through the lenses of race and sex. And those people consider it important that Kamala Harris is a woman. And the argument that the fact she's a woman would be the first woman president is an important thing holds a lot of sway with them. And set against that, you have Donald Trump, of course, who is widely portrayed, fairly or not, as a vile misogynist and is widely seen as a vile misogynist. And on top of that, you have the abortion issue, which, putting morality outside of it and just talking in electoral terms, ever since Dobbs, the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022, Republicans have been losing a lot of elections because of abortions, because you have a highly motivated number of pro-abortion voters who think that women's bodily autonomy is under attack. And so the identity politics about Kamala as a woman are important. You add to that abortion, and she is a formidable candidate and a more formidable candidate than Joe Biden was.
Even though Trump is trying to position himself as more moderate on abortion.
Well, I think what's interesting about that is even though his position is probably more in keeping with the mainstream of America, his view that abortion should be legal in cases of rape, incest and life of the mother is anathema to the progressive mindset. And the progressive mindset dominates the debate about this subject to such an extent that a lot of people will sort of side with Harris on abortion, even if their hearts probably would say they're more in tune with what Trump thinks.
And Amber, it's obviously still quite a long time until the election in November, and Freddie points out in his piece there could well be an October event which changes the race entirely. But at this point, looking ahead, do you think the election is still anyone's to win or lose, or is there a candidate you think at the moment has the edge?
I actually give the edge to Trump in spite of last night's debate performance, because he is actually polling the best he has at this point in an election with any time that he's run. So that New York Times poll that had the candidates effectively tied had Biden up by 8 points back in 2020. Similarly, Trump was behind in pretty much every swing state in both 2016 and 2020 by 3 to 4 points in September and even in October. If he's within 2 points, that's good for him. So I think that's probably indicative of why the Kamala Harris campaign seems to be a little bit off kilter right now. The polls have stabilized pretty significantly since the sort of Harris honeymoon, as we call it here in the United States. They've had actually Joe Biden go out and campaign for her, which hasn't ended well. Yesterday, he said that not on the campaign trail, but notwithstanding, said that he's going to do September 11th today. And they've also been trying out some new messaging against Trump and talking about January 6th and some of these issues from 2020 that are obviously not top of voters' minds. I think that suggests that they know they actually need a lead in the polls in order to be doing well. The polls have always, in America, oversampled Democrats. Republicans, especially in the Trump era, are very loath to answer pollsters. And you can only have an oversampling of Democrats that's so high to wait for before you're actually just straight up manipulating the numbers. I think the proper range is like 5 to 6 points of oversampling is kind of okay. You can wait for that. When you get to 10 to 12, things start to get pretty skewed, and actually being tied or ahead by 2 points is not good news for a Democrat.
Freddie, just finally, you correctly predicted that J.D. Vance would be Trump's running mate. Are you willing to make a prediction on what's going to happen in the election?
I'm going to say that Trump will win, but I have absolutely no confidence in that assessment.
Freddie and Amber, thank you for joining.
Lara, what else did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
There's a piece by Austin Williams in which he says that he recently convened a summer school in a top Shanghai university and asked the class of architectural students who wants to be an architect. And he was very surprised to discover that no one wanted to be an architect. And he says it seems to be the case in China right now that Chinese students and indeed the Chinese in general are turning their back on architecture. And he looks at why that is. He says that studying architecture is increasingly considered to be a sign of decadence or gullibility, which I think is quite interesting. He says, what sort of fool studies architecture in the hope of a more comfortable life? One might also ask, what sort of fool tots up how many rolled up cigarettes they've smoked in their life? But that is exactly what Rory Clark does in Notes on This Week. He says he's 29, and by his calculation, he's rolled 87,600 cigarettes, and he's trying, has never done it, to roll the perfect roll-up cigarette. So I enjoyed that. What about you, Will? What did you enjoy?
Well, our editor, Fraser Nelson, writes the diary for this week's magazine because, as I'm sure many of our listeners will already be aware, the magazine was bought this week by Sir Paul Marshall. And Fraser has taken this opportunity to reflect upon the sale and this next chapter in The Spectator's story. And we can hear an extract from his diary here in which he recalls getting a phone call from an old proprietor of The Spectator.
Algie Clough paid £160,000 for The Spectator in 1980, and pretty much straight away wrote to his new editor with his thoughts on how the magazine he owned could improve, more coverage of Asia, etc. Clough later recalled in his memoirs what happened next. "This he printed as a letter," he said, "as if it were from a reader." Dominic Lawson did exactly the same with Conrad Black's advice. So the Barclay family pretty much got the memo. They gave me not a single editorial hint or suggestion, let alone instruction, in 15 years. Andrew Neil, who has just stood down as chairman after 20 years, dealt with the Barclays, seeing it as his job to protect our editorial freedom, freedom that we use to quintuple our value. And that's the whole thing about The Spectator. Editorial independence isn't an optional extra. It's what makes The Spectator. Decades of experience, good and bad, testify to that. And as Sir Paul Marshall has made clear, it's a formula he seeks to protect and invest in. Last week, at a live recording of Coffeehouse Shots, a gloomy reader asked what, if anything, was good or unusual about Britain. The great Alan Clark, when he was asked the same question by a schoolboy, replied, "Britain produces people like you who ask questions like that." He meant it as a rebuke, but to be honest, I'm not so sure. Great nations are always self-critical. My immigrant wife puts it very well. She says she's moved to the best country on earth, but one that is weirdly determined never to admit to the fact. Kimmy Badenoch, my former colleague at The Spectator, also has what you might call immigrant patriotism. When she worked here as digital chief, she would berate me for running so many negative articles. Now, if you ask me, we're effervescent about this country compared with most other publications, but obviously not enough for her. But growing up in Nigeria, she saw Britain not just as a country, but as an ideal. And this is the kind of point which is obviously lost on us natives. So how to answer the guy at the podcast who asked that question? In the end, I solicited some help from Robert Burns. "Oh, add some power, the gifty Gius, to see ourselves as others see us." Last week, I was delighted to come back from lunch to find a note asking me to call Sir Henry Keswick, who's now 85. I wanted to tell him how much the magazine he saved is now going for. "I know," he replied. "And if a new proprietor asks, I'll recommend that he fires you." I was a bit crestfallen and I asked why. He said, quite rightly, that we didn't review a book by Tessa, his late wife, about her time in China. I tried to make my case to him. I said that my colleague Cindy Yu loved the book so much that she, at the time of its publication, recorded an interview with Tessa for her brilliant podcast, Chinese Whispers, and in so doing made a permanent record of Tessa's wit and warmth. Sir Henry hadn't been aware. We are, I like to think, on good terms now, and I'm delighted if so. Without him, this magazine story might have ended 50 years ago. But as things stand, its best chapter may very well be about to begin.
The second piece we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail is by The Spectator's online commissioning editor, Max Jeffrey. And he's written about London Overwatch, which is a paedophile hunting group. They pose as children online to snare unsuspecting sexual predators. They then confront the suspects and live stream the arrest to thousands of viewers. Well, Max went along with them on a sting to see them catch a man who believed he had been speaking to a 14-year-old girl. Max joined me to talk about his piece more, along with Nick, who runs London Overwatch.
Yeah, paedophile hunting groups have been around for a while, maybe 10 years, maybe longer. I came across these groups most recently on Twitter, and I think, I don't know if everyone has this, maybe I've got a slightly strange timeline, but when you scroll down there, it doesn't take long before you find these paedophile hunting videos. And often they're American, and they're groups of nowadays influencers, and they'll go out and try and hunt paedophiles. And they've kind of turned into this ludicrous scenes where you have celebrities going on stings, you have people who started their careers making vlogs for teenagers going on stings, and they'll prank them in weird ways, they'll force them to eat hot food before the police arrive, and it's turned into a strange kind of form of entertainment.
Mm. I mean, that does sound all quite strange, but the thing that you went on, was that, did you find that similarly strange?
No, it was much more, it felt much more proper. I'm not just saying that because Nick's here, but there was none of the weirdness there, but still that underlying strangeness of seeing a suspected paedophile face to face and watching someone's life fall apart before your eyes.
Nick, I wonder if you could start by telling our listeners how you started all this up in the first place. How did you become a paedophile hunter?
It was through a friend of mine, a guy named Jay. He runs a really good team called Cobra, who do things in a very similar way to us. I started helping him out mid-2019, and things kind of progressed from there. And London Overwatch, which is a team that I run with a guy called Lloyd, we split off a couple of years ago just to do things slightly different. The guys that come out with us are mostly my friend group, and we've all got jobs and kids. So we wanted to fit it in a little bit more around us to do as much as we can. And it sort of led on from there, really. Just kind of ease, really. It was more, you know, we wanted a bit of control over what we do. We try and go for, you know, particularly bad guys. We take our time. And it was just kind of the way I like to do it. So, yeah, I kind of got into it through someone else and just carried it on.
And in terms of the process of the whole thing then, I mean, Max writes about how there's a decoy, you know, a member of your team who communicates with the suspect, and they get chatting until you feel like there's enough evidence to then swoop in. I mean, so presumably you have to be absolutely certain that you're on the right side of the law before you sweep in and call the police, don't you?
100%. I mean, I'll try not to chatter for too long, but the basics are that an adult creates a child account using, obviously, you know, pictures of kids that they've got permission for, or, you know, they use software to make themselves younger, whatever. The kids are usually 11 to 13, 14 years of age. They lie dormant on social media sites, chat rooms, and they wait to be approached by potential online sexual predators. The predator makes first contact, initiates the conversation. The decoy will then state their age 2, 3, 4, 5 times throughout the chat log. The decoys are also trained to reference the age, so child-specific activities, things like that. If offences are committed, they're recorded, they're screenshot. There's a way that the CPS and the police like to receive that information, so all the girls are trained to collect the data that way. And then once we've got enough evidence, we're normally looking for 3, 4, 5 high court charges. Once we've got that, we'll then either pass it directly over to the police, or we'll go out ourselves and have a chat with the guys. We try and keep it really calm. I don't like the optics of having people, you know, some of them are rolling around on the ground and stuff like that. We don't do that. We try and be polite and respectful as much as we can, get hold of the guys, and we ask them some questions and we live stream it. We do that for a number of reasons. As I was explaining to Max, we get a lot more charges go through to the police and the CPS as a result of live streaming, because other teams come forward. They'll tell us that they've got a decoy who's also talking to that gentleman, and we put all the evidence together and we submit it in one big file. And also we live stream because we feel it's a deterrent. We're a group of fathers. We all work, you know, in the city. We all try hard, and we're sick to death of how badly the internet is being abused, and how much, you know, and how much risk our kids are being put at on a day-to-day basis. It's an absolute cancer of our society. And the police do a great job. I wouldn't want to criticise them. They do something very similar, but it's such an overwhelming problem that we feel something needs to be done about it, and we're trying to go about it the best way we can within the confines of the law. Hmm.
Do you ever follow the cases of the suspects once they've been had into the police? Do you ever see someone, you know, the news of someone going to prison, you think that's someone that we've...
Yeah. Every single one. So when we turn up to a sting, I have with me a full evidence pack. In that evidence pack is the chat log, which shows the evidence that we've got against the guy. It also has a series of what the police call MG11s, which is a police statement form. So there'll be one from the decoy, one from myself, and perhaps some other people in my team. That gets given to the police. We're then technically witnesses. We follow every single case from arrest through to conviction. You know, some of the convictions that, you know, I've seen since I've been doing this have been as high as sort of, you know, 11 or 12 years. Mm. If it's a first-time offender and it's, you know, not really serious, you'll probably be looking at anything from a suspended sentence up to a couple of years. But it's very, very common to see 3, 4, 5 years, sexual harm prevention order, sex offenders register. The police take this very seriously. They do a great job. And yeah, we follow it every step of the way. It's extremely important for us to know the outcome of what we're doing.
Yeah. And how many paedophiles do you think you've caught since you started doing it?
About somewhere between 250 and 300.
Wow. Yeah,
I've been a part of, like, through London Overwatch, I think we're about 100. And then I was with Cobra for a long time before that. And I think we did, you know, over 200 with those guys. And that's just the ones that are live streamed. A lot are passed directly to the police for them to do their work.
And Max, there's an element of your piece which you sort of hinted at earlier in this podcast, but I want to draw out a bit more if that's all right, which is the horrid joy that you felt at the end of the whole thing. And that's the phrase you used, horrid joy. I wonder if you could explain that a bit more for our listeners. Did you have sort of conflicted feelings about the whole thing?
Yeah, it is conflicted because you're watching, as I said, someone's life fall apart, which is the horrid part. But then there is a joy in this person is a paedophile or a suspected paedophile at that point. And I think you get a similar feeling when you watch the stranger videos online, the more extreme ones, of there's a silliness to paedophilia in a way today, in that you go on these videos and you can laugh along to watching some person get forced to eat cat food on a live stream when they're accused of being a paedophile. The paedophile hunting team hasn't called the police yet. They're saying, if you eat this cat food, we'll leave you alone. And you can sit there and laugh at that, while at the same time, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, but this person has thought that they're talking to a child and has tried to meet up with them for sex. And so I think the whole thing is very strange. And maybe it is part of this weird thing that's happened to paedophilia, where it has become almost funny in the way that nonce has become a playground insult for kids, for example.
Nick, I wonder how you view groups like the ones that Max is describing, the ones that are a bit more extreme in the way they do things. There's a kind of nastiness to the way they do things. Are they unhelpful to the image of the work you do you think?
No, not really. I laugh at them too, mate, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
I think they deserve it. Every one of the teams that you see operating in the UK has gone there with evidence. Okay, if you don't have evidence and you live stream someone like that, you're going to get arrested. So, you know, the person they're there to sting will be guilty of what the guys are saying. How they go about doing it is up to them. You know, I do things the way I do because I want everybody to go home safe. I don't want to get arrested. People who choose to do that, that's up to them. You know, like what Max was saying, there's a lot of guys in the States, you know, that are kind of assaulting people and they're doing stuff like that. You know, I'm not going to support it, but it is what it is. I think if you make the decision that you want to molest a child, you know, you're going to bear the brunt of that decision, aren't you, at the end of the day? It's not how I would do things, but I understand why people feel that strongly.
And finally, is it ethical to pocket a sandwich for lunch at a hotel breakfast buffet? That's the question that Laurie Graham explores in this week's magazine, and she says she thinks it's a peculiarly British habit. So, to discuss, Laurie joined us earlier alongside Mark Jenkins, a former hotel manager in Torquay, who listeners may remember from the Channel 4 documentary The Hotel. I started by asking Laurie why, while she herself seems to remain on the fence, she seems to think this is such a big issue.
Okay, well, cards on the table, because obviously I've given this a lot of thought for writing the piece, and then since, because I've had reason to stay in an hotel since I wrote the piece and had the opportunity to. I noticed you used the word steal.
Implicit bias within the question.
Exactly. But I'm truly still on the fence because in my head, I think, I've paid for breakfast. I can have whatever I want. And even if I'm not going to eat it in the dining room. So that's what intellectually I think is the case. I'm looking forward to hearing what Mark has to say. But in my heart, I can't bring myself to do it.
Why do you think?
I think one of the things I fear is being challenged. You know, madam, do you have something in your hand? I mean, I can't think of any other rational reason for it.
And you say it's a peculiarly British habit. When did you notice that?
Well, I was travelling with a group of people, most of whom were Brits, but not all. And it was, I mean, this may have been coincidental, but I have a feeling, we did talk about it a little bit because I was very shocked at what I witnessed. And we talked in the group about it. And they said, well, you know, English people, we're careful with money and we don't, why waste the opportunity to buy lunch out, especially if you're travelling, can be expensive. Why not do it? It never occurred to me.
Mark, as a hotel manager, I think we need to get your perspective on this question. Are guests allowed to take food from the hotel buffet, or is it an unwritten rule not to?
I mean, no, you shouldn't take it. You know, I think the problem is what you've just been saying about being a British thing, I think it's absolutely correct. It's a bit like drinking, you know, sort of, you know, when we go abroad, we can't handle it because we're not brought up with it. You know, on the continent from a young age, you know, a glass of wine with the meals is quite normal. So people get used to alcohol, you know, from a very young age. But, you know, we go crazy when there's too much alcohol. And partly, I don't think it's about saving money. It's the same with food. We're not brought up with a table full of sharing food like they are abroad. You know, their family mealtimes are completely different from ours. There'll be a table full of food and people are talking, just sort of share it around. For us sort of Brits, it's only what's been sort of dished up on a plate. So we're not used to it when there's a huge buffet and you can just help yourself and have as much as you want. I mean, I blame the hotels, really, you know, because it makes it too tempting. When I took over my hotels, I had three hotels. They used to do buffet self-service breakfast. And the first thing I did was stop them.
Ah, would you want hotel staff to reprimand guests if they catch them doing it?
Well, yes. I mean, it is. I understand what you're saying about being a grey area, but it is sort of wrong, really. I mean, if you went to a nice restaurant one evening and there was you went out somewhere and there was a sort of a buffet, maybe a help yourself salad bar, you'd know it would be wrong to steal the food and take it home for tomorrow's lunch. You know, it's only for consumption while you're there in the restaurant. So why is it okay to do it in a hotel? And why is a breakfast buffet any different?
Well, it's more portable.
Well, that's where I partly blame the hotels, you know, because the problem is it's what they're giving for breakfast. You know, all these sort of slices of cooked meats, various cheeses, bread rolls, pastries, fresh fruit. When was the last time you woke up on holiday and said, I'm on holiday, I'm going to treat myself, I really fancy a cheese roll for breakfast? Never. You know, I mean, no one's going to tip a bowl of cornflakes in one pocket and a rasher of bacon and a fried egg in the other pocket, sneak it out the dining room to eat for lunch, are they? So the real problem is, why are these hotels serving packed lunch items or picnic fare for breakfast in the first place?
Well, I think surely it's for foreign tourists, because a typical German breakfast, for instance, would have slices of cheese, slices of meat. So I guess big hotel buffets are catering to that. And then British people who want to save a few quid think, oh, well, I can take a roll and there's lunch.
Laura, your article has sparked quite a lot of debate in our office this week. And one of the arguments I've heard being discussed is that it can be embarrassing when you see a family member taking food from the buffet. Would you agree with that? That it can be quite embarrassing if you're with someone who's sort of pocketing lots of food?
So the hotel I stayed in recently, where I didn't take anything, by the way, from the buffet, but I had one of my daughters with me, and I told her what was on my mind, and she said, "Don't you dare." So I do think there's an element of that. And in the group, you know, when this first arose, when I was in Sweden and this whole thing first came up for me, there were two sisters who were travelling together. And one of them had really furnished their lunch from the breakfast buffet. But the other sister was disapproving. She still ate it, of course. But on the whole, she thought it was just not quite the thing.
The fact that people who do it, when you do this, you know, you wait until other guests and certainly members of staff, that they're not watching you. You do it secretly. And the reason you do it secretly and don't just do it openly is because you know technically what you're doing is wrong. I mean, it's no different than shoplifting or not scanning something at a self-service checkout till.
Well, but hang on, Mark, is it really exactly the same as that? Because, I mean, you as Laurie says, you know, that you have paid for the breakfast.
Well, it's... people know, as I said, the fact that if you're doing it, you're frightened that somebody might see you. And that is an admission of guilt that, yes, it might be a buffet breakfast. It might be an all you can eat and you can go up as many times as you want and you know, have as much as you want. But the unwritten rule is it's for consumption whilst you're in the dining room.
I would love to, just finally, Mark, I love your opinion about other things that people get in hotels, because Laurie has, an extremely interesting list of some of the things that people take or don't take from their room. So, you know, things such as, she writes, a pen, a notepad, tea bags, there's those little bottles of shampoo, there's even those throwaway slippers. I mean, what's your opinion about those sorts of things and whether people should take those things home with them? And what's perhaps the strangest thing that someone has attempted to take from one of the hotels that you've worked in?
Well, I had a hotel, one of the series I did, I went to work at another hotel, and they had a problem with TV remote controls. so they kept, this is true, this was on the TV show. So they kept them all behind reception, and they were only handed out when you checked in. They gave them out with a room key. And at the end of your stay, you had to remember to take the TV remote back to reception and hand it back in with your room key. I mean, that was unbelievable. The most annoying thefts I had from my hotels were things like the batteries from the remotes, because often the housekeeping staff didn't check the televisions. So, you know, suddenly, why would people steal a battery? As far as toiletries, things like that, nowadays, a lot more hotels, because of the sort of the whole green thing, there's less of them having a whole array of different miniature toiletries that you can just sort of swoop up and take them all home. A lot of the thing now in a lot of hotels is to have larger refillable sort of soaps and different things, so there isn't so much sort of wastage. But yeah, it's things like slippers. You know, you definitely can't take the dressing gowns. the whole sort of joke thing of, you know, I could hardly close my suitcase because the towels were so big and fluffy. You know, again, you shouldn't be stealing towels or anything. I think the worst thing that ever happened to me personally was one of my hotels. I just spent quite a lot, thousands of pounds, upgrading all the rooms, changing all the bedspreads and all the curtains. And I had 54 bedrooms and all the curtains were, you know, sort of made to measure. Cost me a lot of money so I swapped them all over and they're all modern and matching. And we just finished swapping them over in the rooms. And that day we had what we call a family walk-in. So they paid cash for the room. For some reason, we didn't get any details and there was no CCTV back then. Anyway, so this was a family with three children, a big family room. Early the following morning, the night porter saw them coming out their room struggling with lots of black bags. And he actually helped them via a fire escape door carry them to the car park. Now, when the housekeeping went into the room later, the curtains, and they had two big windows, and all the bedspreads, the double and the three single bedspreads, were all gone. They pinched the whole lot.
Gosh.
That was the worst theft I ever had from a hotel room.
Yeah, and it starts at a breakfast buffet exactly. And then you don't know where you end up.
Exactly, that's where it ends.
Well, Laurie and Mark, thank you both very much indeed for joining us. Thank you. And that's it for this week. But as ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, why not pick up a copy of the magazine to read everything we've talked about in full? And if you're listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast. And we really do hope you join us again next week.